So our topic for tonight is the Second Aliyah, 1904 to 1914. And I want to contrast the Second Aliyah with the First Aliyah. You see, the First Aliyah, which was from 1881 till roughly the turn of the century, did not really produce a new Jew, a new farmer Jew. Because the people who went didn't know what they were getting into. They arrived and faced great difficulty, and then ended up being supported financially by the Baron, Edmund Rothschild of Paris, Hanadiv Hayadua, the known philanthropist. And over time, they developed a colonialist system whereby they were really just like the leaseholders, as Jews were in Poland, and locals did much of the work. Who were the locals? The Arabs. So it was not really avodah ivrit in the fullest sense of Hebrew labor, but rather the reliance upon locals. And it mimicked colonial systems that existed all around the world. Moreover, the Jew was able to mistreat the Arab because the Jews had the money, courtesy of the Baron, and the Jews had the law on their side, the Turks, the Ottoman authorities. So it was a situation of like when a slave reigns, the roles are reversed, that the Jew was the downtrodden ethnic minority.
And the Turks work with the Jews rather than the Arabs.
The Turks were just interested in preserving law and order early on. And the Jews had a decent relationship with Turkish authorities during the First Aliyah, especially among those who adopted Ottoman citizenship. If they accepted Ottoman citizenship, so that was an advantage to them. No, they did, but they were low ranking in the grand scheme of things. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that a boss is treating an employee like an employee, but sometimes even worse. And we find in the Talmud an expression, Am hadomela chamor. Am hadomela chamor. What does that mean? A nation that's like a camel. Okay, so who is the Am hadomela chamor?
The Jews.
Who's the Am hadomela chamor? Everybody but the Jews, all the goyim. Now, in Europe, if you were to say that, and they know what you were saying, they'd kill you. You'd get in big, big trouble. But in First Aliyah Eretz Yisrael, the Jews can get away with it, and there's no self-censorship. Very important, no self-censorship anymore. They think they're the king of the castle. They're not, but they think along those lines. So this is the colonialist approach of the farmers of the First Aliyah. They don't... It was a fairly desolate country. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of Arabs, but the
kings of garbage, basically.
All right, maybe.
Compared to Poland, where they might have had a business or whatever, they were chased out because they didn't
have money. It's hard to depict it like that, but all right, yeah.
So, would you be able to contrast the difference in the motivation between the First
Aliyah? Okay, good. I'm going to get to that. So, the First Aliyah was motivated principally by just a desire to be in Eretz Yisrael. The traditional Chibat Zion, love of Zion, of the old school variety, meaning we are Jews and we've always had a yearning to return to our ancient homeland. And for the Jews of the First Aliyah, they did not need to justify Jewish possession of Eretz Yisrael. It was taken for granted that the Jews have title to Eretz Yisrael. There was no discussion of the matter, of the legitimacy of our action of settlement, but rather it was taken for granted. Yeah.
Were they more Orthodox?
Yes, absolutely. The First Aliyah included many very pious Jews. The Second Aliyah, almost none. Almost none. Okay, so the First Aliyah had an unknown total number of Jews, but at the end of the century, in 1900, there were approximately 50,000 Jews living in the country, of whom about 10,000 were not of the old Yishuv, meaning they were of the newer variety. So that gives you a number of about 10,000, but more than that number moved there in the first place. Just people left. They come for a little while and they go home because they just can't handle it. All right. So the second Aliyah is going to change things up a little bit. There is a motivation of chalutziyut, of pioneering, that dominates the second Aliyah. And labor Zionism, or socialist Zionism. The two are not the same. You can have there's the possibility of non-socialist labor Zionism, which I'll get to soon enough. So, in 1903, you have the Kishinev pogrom. In 1905, you have the pogroms that were associated with the failed Russian Revolution. And it's very bad for the Jews. In fact, the Jewish immigration to America reaches a high point in 1904, 5, and 6 because it's very, very dangerous in Russia. Existential threat to Jewish existence. And the vast bulk of people who are leaving Russia will go to the Americas. Only a small percentage will go to Eretz Yisrael. But who's going? Well, the answer is, for the most part, socialist or labor Zionists who have been indoctrinated in Russia in this concept of labor Zionism, and they wake up one day and realize, what are we doing? What am I doing here? What are we all doing here? Why am I not there? Why are we not all there? So the writers, the poets, the ideologues, okay, they can write over whatever they want. But in fact, they're mostly writing from the Chutz La'aretz. And you can soak up this information and these concepts while sitting down in a shtetl in Plonsk, or in a city, Minsk, wherever. But then you suddenly wake up and say, okay, but now I have to move. There's no justification for me remaining where I am. I have to pick up and go somewhere. So this is the motivation of the second Aliyah, that begins in earnest in 1904 and doesn't really peter out until the start of the First World War. They have a goal, and that goal is not only to transform Eretz Yisrael, but also to transform themselves. Anu banu arza, livnot ulehi banotba. We went to Israel to build and to be built there. So the two are equally important. They're changing themselves just as they're changing the face of the country. And they believe very firmly that Avodah Ivrit is essential. And anything that is not Avodah Ivrit is Avodah Zara. Whoa. So we're using theological terms. Idolatry. Avodah Zara. Avodah Zara. If you rely upon Arab labor, it's a big sin to rely upon Arab labor. Even the dirtiest of jobs have to be done by the Jews themselves. Well, what is the attitude of the farmers of the first Aliyah towards the newcomers of the second Aliyah? So it's actually not a very good relationship at first. In some respects, the first Aliyah farmers, who now were a bit more prosperous, regarded the second Aliyah Jews as unemployable. Why are they unemployable? So they're not really unemployable. However, it's maybe preferable from an economic point of view to hire local Arab labor. Because number one, they'll work for a pittance, that their standard of living is a lot lower than the European standard of living of the Jew who just came off the boat. That Jew is going to demand a certain salary, which was not much, but still respectable, more respectable than what the Arab fellahin are willing to work for. But also, the Arab doesn't complain. The Arab doesn't talk politics. What are these second Aliyah Jews doing more than anything else? Talking politics. Grand socialist ideology. They have dreams of the future. Well, when you're talking about the future, and a glorious future at that, it distracts you from shoveling the manure. So it's easier to hire an Arab who won't think much about anything, doesn't need culture, doesn't need literacy, just will work, as opposed to the Jews who are a little bit more sophisticated and therefore annoying. All right. Uh-huh. Okay, that's a very good question. The Arab, the stereotype of the Arab, which developed at this time, was that they were lazy, that they were slothful, they were unclean, that they had an occasional penchant for violence, but that they would work for next to nothing. So you have to balance out a laziness factor if no one is watching them, but if someone is supervising them, they will do the work, and they'll work for a really low price, a really low wage. As opposed to the Jew, whose work ethic has yet to be proven, and those who are not cut out for physical labor will do one of two things. Either leave the country or become a politician, like Ben-Gurion. Or, if they are cut out for physical labor, they'll do it, and they'll do it till their bones are aching. All right. The trajectory of work life for a second Aliyah Jew, they get off the boat, they're in Jaffa. So they might stay there for a while, just because you can get a meal, and you can have somewhere to sleep for the night. But then they want to go onto the land, onto the farms. But which one? So if they're lucky, they'll get some temporary work at the Mikveh Israel Agricultural School, or at Petach Tikva, or Zichron Yaakov, one of the established first Aliyah Yishuvim. But that's only going to go so far, and there are only so many jobs there. At some point, you have to strike out on your own and go to new territory. And so there are settlements which are established around this time. Sejera, Meshem, Nachamiya, Yavnel, Beit Gan, Mitzpah, and Kinneret. Yeah. So the sum total from 1904 to 1914 is about 35,000. Of the 35,000, only about 5,000 stayed behind the whole way through. The other 30,000, at some point, left. They went to find greener pastures in America or wherever, or back to Europe. Okay. So it's a very small number that can say, I survived the second Aliyah. But those handful of people, those few thousand, became what? The founders of the State of Israel. Ben-Gurion, Ben-Svi, the cadre of leadership of the Yishuv in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, into the first years of statehood, it's all second Aliyah. And they hung around a long time. And plenty of people who were from the third and fourth Aliyah were waiting for them to drop dead, or just to retire, which they never would. So this group was in charge for a long, long time. Okay. Well, yeah.
The first Aliyah.
Yeah.
Okay. The rate of return back to Europe or America, wherever, was that as much as?
It's comparable for the first and the second, but I would say the following: the first Aliyah suffered from an additional problem, that of having children who grew up in Eretz Yisrael. But who leave and do not return, they leave for educational reasons, that they don't have good schooling in Eretz Yisrael, and they go off to France or to Germany to get an education in the gymnasia or the university, and then they've seen a wider world, and they're not going to go back to the petty little yeshuvim under the baron in 1903 Palestine. So some do come back out of filial piety or loyalty to Zionism, but a lot of them don't.
The original nutrition rate, great.
It was very high for first and second. Yeah. Yes, the founding of high schools and universities in Eretz Yisrael was in part to build up the cultural center, but also to keep the kids in the country. You don't lose them. Yeah.
So all these people would go back with bad PR on their tongues.
Uh-huh.
Did that become a disincentive for other people?
Okay. Good. Good. The answer to that is, to an extent, yes. But for one specific matter, no. There was a lot of disinformation, fake news. And that has to do with security, self-defense, the issue of whether it's dangerous to live in Eretz Yisrael. And in about 20 minutes, we'll address that point. Okay. So there are new yeshuvim being built and the beginning of the kvutzah. What is a kvutzah? So a kibbutz is the physical location. The kvutzah was the group of people. The kvutzah could wander around from one place to another until eventually they settle upon a location that they decide, here we will be permanently. So the early kibbutzim were run by kvutzot that might have bounced around in the Galilee from here or there, a few different places, until they settled down. For example, Dagania is the mother of the kibbutzim. That kvutzah was in one location, a second location, finally a third location. They settled down permanently at Dagania. Then there's Dagania Bet. Okay. So.
Yavne is
kvutzah. Ah, yeah? To this day, Arayom Hazeh? Kvitzat Yavne. They kept the old name. Now, Arthur Ruppin is a name you never heard of, right? You never heard of Arthur Ruppin?
I heard of him.
Okay, some of you heard of Arthur Ruppin. Arthur Ruppin, Correct. He ran the Zionist organization Palestine Office. In 1908, the Zionist organization finally opens up an office in Eretz Yisrael. Otherwise, it was run out of Europe. And this office, by Ruppin, or Ruppin in Hebrew, but in the original German it was Ruppin, is going to take JNF money and parcel it out, buying a plot here, a plot there, a plot everywhere, so that people can farm the land. Which land is going to be purchased? Well, whatever is available. And what the Zionists quickly find out is that the country actually has many inhabitants already there, and the best cultivable land is already under cultivation. And what is available for purchase is mostly second and third rate. That is ridden with malaria or full of rocks that has to be cleared away. It's not easy to even get off the ground an agricultural settlement because the topography and the circumstances don't lend to it. So you're buying land which is not a very good land. But it wasn't always so cheap. Now, who's the seller? The seller typically is not the person who lives there. The seller is an absentee landowner who has tenant farmers. Well, what happens to those tenant farmers when the JNF, on behalf of whatever group of Jews, buys it? What happens to those people? Do they get thrown out? Yes or no? So it's a big question. Which brings us to the main focus for tonight. And that is the Arab question. The Arab question. Usually not. Usually it's a private landowner who might have lived in Beirut or Damascus or Aleppo or wherever. No, they weren't Jews. They were typically Arabs, and Arabs who didn't live in Eretz Israel, but who owned land, because remember, these were one large province. So, what do you do with the Arabs? There is a notion in the study of Zionism that the Arab question was ignored completely in the earliest phases of the movement, and that they only woke up sometime after the Arab riots in the 20s and 30s to realize, wow, this country wasn't empty. We didn't come to an empty land, but rather there are people here. No, that's not really what happened. Already from the beginning, there was an awareness by the people on the ground in Eretz Yisrael and by some wise people in Europe that Eretz Yisrael is not empty, that there are people who live there. Several hundred thousand, too. All right. So in 1905, Yitzhak Epstein, who was a teacher, a Hebrew teacher in Eretz Yisrael, he wrote an article and he delivered a paper at the Zionist Congress, at the 7th Zionist Congress. The title of the paper was The Hidden Question, The Arabs of Palestine and Jewish Attitudes Towards Them, in which he said, we cannot ignore the existence of the population here, that it may be convenient for the writers in Chutz La'aretz, who don't have to face them in the flesh, to pretend as though this is an empty country. But we who live there know otherwise. Now, Epstein's theory was, let's be good to the Arabs and help them raise up their material, their social and material standards, and they'll be appreciative of Zionism, and they won't complain too much. Now, he said, we cannot assume that forever the Arabs will be devoid of nationalist sentiment. They will, just like everyone else in the world, develop a national movement at some point or another. The only question is when, and how much time do we as Zionists have before they wake up to our intentions? And we have to act quickly. But in the short term, we can curry good favor with them by making sure they benefit from our buildup of the economy. Now, that's a theory. That's what he's suggesting. However, others disagreed with him and thought either that there's no problem or that Epstein's proposal actually is disadvantageous to Zionism. So Menachem Ussishkin, who was the leader of the Russian Zionists and who would go on to become the chief land buyer in the 1920s and 30s during the Yishuv, and he's an important player. Every town in Israel has a Ussishkin Street. Okay, He said the Arabs of Palestine are on good terms with the Jews and recognize unconditionally the historical title of the Jews to the land. Is that true?
No.
He was smoking something when he said that. All right, but that's what Ossishkin said in 1905. He would himself have to acknowledge 20, 30 years later that that's simply inaccurate, but that's what he could think in 1905. Hillel Zeitlin was a leading Zionist, and he became a territorialist. Why? Well, you could figure it out. If we're talking about how there are people who live in this country who are non-Jews, and that there isn't that much available land for purchase or for settlement, then the solution to the Jewish problem, the national solution to the Jewish problem, is going to be where? Not in Israel. Somewhere else. Argentina, Alaska, Hawaii, wherever, but not Israel. So Zeitlin, he says, what all the Palestinians forget, and by the way, who are the Palestinians? The Palestinians are the Zionists of Zion, the Tzionei Tzion, meaning the non-Ugandists. The Ugandists are the territorialists. The Tzionei Tzion are the Palestinians, the ones who say only Israel. What they forget, mistakenly or maliciously, is that Palestine belongs to others and is totally settled. Whoa, that's tough words. For a Jew to say those words, he meant it, and he really believed that. So, but notice he says mistakenly or maliciously. There are two different situations here. The Jews of Chutz La'aretz, who don't really know what's happening in Israel, they could mistakenly think the country is empty. But the propagandists who live in Israel and who know better are doing it maliciously. They're just so enthralled there at Israel and convinced that the national solution must be in Palestine that they're willing to lie in their propaganda about what the prospects are for taking over the country, which he thinks are nil. Okay.
Wasn't the actual Palestinian Arabs a very small group at that time?
No, they were still outnumbering the Jews by 9-1.
I mean, not to the Arab. Yeah. Yeshua walked into an Arab country. Yeah. Yeshua conquered.
Okay, so a friend of mine just asked on Facebook. He just asked, I want to read more about Zionism, so what should I read? And I said, read Roman Jerusalem, read Der Judenstaat, Alt New Land, Lozu HaDerech, all the stuff we've been learning about, Ottoman Emancipation. And the next guy in the comments said, read Sefer Yoshua. There's nothing more Tzioni than that.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm confused about the role of the Ottoman Empire during this.
Yeah.
Even though they were considered the sick man of Europe.
Right.
So
their control over Eretz Yisrael weakened tremendously after the 1908 Young Turk Revolution. And the local administration in any given region could be strong, it could be weak. But central authority had been greatly weakened. So one of the issues was that physical security for Jews had been taken for granted from 1881 to the early 1900s on the grounds that the Ottomans don't want to see blood in the streets. But once the Ottoman rule was very weak, and really they could not guarantee the personal security of individuals, so then that was a reason to not go to Israel. But what would happen? The propaganda coming out of Eretz Yisrael was, it's all fine and dandy. Like an El Al brochure in 2002, well, there's no intifada to see here. That's the same thing. It's very dangerous. You shouldn't come. But, please come on in. There's nothing, no problems. That was the attitude in the late Ottoman period. Yeah.
The world order was about to be upended with the self-determination movements of
right.
World War One. That's one aspect that would galvanize desire for self-determination.
Yeah.
The other is the instigation of Lawrence of Arabia.
Which right, so Arab nationalism will be instigated by World War One because of several factors, but remember, up until World War One begins, nobody knows that the world order is going to be totally transformed. People think still in very conventional terms. What I know now is what will be tomorrow, and the day after, and the day after that, and I have to live with it. The reality is otherwise. You have tumultuous events, but until it happens, you don't know what's going to happen. So, Nordau, Max Nordau, who had been Herzl's number two guy in the movement, he said that the Arabs are going to rebel against Turkey, and the Jews won't. But the Arabs aren't going to win. And so Turkey will give Palestine to the Jews as a reward for keeping the region calm. Did that happen? Not any one part of that sentence ever came true. All four pieces of that puzzle are completely incorrect. But that was Nordau thinking in 1905. It's a pipe dream. It didn't come to pass. Then, the young guard within the Zionist movement, they theorized that the Arabs will rebel, and the Jews will help the Arabs rebel. And the Arabs will give Palestine to the Jews as a gift, as a todah rabah, that you gave us freedom in all of our other regions. Did that happen?
No.
Okay. So, alternatively, the Zionists of Zion would say, the Jews will take the land by force if we have to. Now, bear in mind the following. This is November 27th it is today, whatever it is. We've been learning Zionism now for a goodly number of weeks. This is the first time I've said that the Zionists are going to take something by force. Everything we've learned until now was shalom. Herzl believed international guarantees, peaceful settlement. There was never an intention in early Zionism for Israel to be a garrison state that is established in blood and fire. The assumption had always been that the obstacle to Jewish statehood was the international diplomatic arena. And as long as we convince the goyim that this is kosher, it will come to pass nicely and cleanly. Now you finally have somebody saying, well, and if it doesn't happen, we'll grab it and we'll kill people to do so. Well, the idea that you have to take the land by force means that the Arabs don't like us and they don't want us here. But people were reluctant to accept that fact. And so in socialist Zionism, you have the following theory. Ber Baruchov, who's the godfather of Marxist Zionism, he says, we won't have a problem with the Arabs. Why? Because they're Semites, just like us. We're B'nai Shem, we're cousins. And even better, the local Arabs of Palestine are actually the descendants of the Canaanim and the Yisraelim who were forcibly converted to Islam 1,400 years ago. So they're actually ex-Jews. So we're really going to be on great terms with them. Is there any truth to that?
No.
So there is some truth to the, genealogically that the Arabs of Palestine have some genetic connection to the Jews. Well, he would say the Canaanites, not the Israelites. Canaanites, yeah. But otherwise, the Semitic cousin factor is a non-factor. Arab anti-Semitism is just as strong as European Christian anti-Semitism, at least in the 20th century. Then, the question Baruchov has to face is, well, so the Arabs are here, and you say they're going to get along with us. Well, which culture is going to be the dominant one in this future society? Arab or Jewish? And he would say, the Arabs will assimilate into Jewish culture because ours is superior. Whoa. Was he right or was he wrong? He was right. No, he was 100% right. If you go to Jerusalem today, and you're walking on the street, and you're by the light rail, and somebody's asking for directions, and they're Arab, and they're looking at you, and you have a yarmulke on your head, what language is he going to speak in?
Hebrew.
Bingo. So, Hebrew. So, at the end of the day, yes, Jewish culture was superior, technologically, in terms of literacy rates, economically, in every regard, the Jews were superior to the Arabs, which is why, in 1947, November 29th, up until May 14th, 1948, so during the Civil War, who won the Civil War? The Jews won. Okay, then there's a war against the Arab states, but in the Civil War in Palestine between Jews and Arabs, the Jews basically won.
Which year are you talking about?
I'm talking about 47. All the way from 1905 to 1947, there is a living and breathing reality that the Arabs are backward and the Jews are more advanced. And that is why, in the Civil War of 47-48, the Jews easily win. Yeah.
You're calling it Jewish culture, but isn't it really European culture?
European Jewish Hebrew culture. Zionist culture. Okay. All right. So, now, had the territorialists not brought up the matter of the Arabs, in truth, it would have gotten very little attention. Because, yes, Epstein wrote his article, Zeitlin, the territorialist, is complaining. Achad Am is complaining that, you know, there are Arabs here and their country is not empty. But for the most part, the Zionist leadership doesn't want to talk about this. And they don't. So, Anita Shapira, who in my view is the best scholar of early Zionism, and maybe one of the best historians on the history of the State of Israel, she had the following to say about what the Zionist leadership thought of the Arabs. Quote, "The Arabs in Palestine were viewed as one of the many misfortunes present in Palestine, like the Ottoman authorities, the climate, difficulties of adjustment, no greater or smaller than other troubles the settlers had to grapple with. In other words, the Arabs, the malaria, the swamp, the weather, it's all part of the mix. Life is difficult, and it's another problem we deal with, but it's not any greater or lesser than all the other things I just mentioned. Then, when it came to the concrete relevance about the fate of the Arabs, such deliberations about Arabs in Palestine had about the same importance as the learned disputations customarily held in the courtyards of the Hasidic rabbis regarding what would happen after the coming of the Messiah." In other words, it's Hilchas al-Mashiach to worry about what's going to be with the Arabs in the grand scheme of Zionism in the State of Israel. That's what people thought in 1907. Of course, 40 years later, they realized, no, this is the biggest issue of them all. And our life and death will hang in the balance. But in 1905, 1907, to worry about what's going to be with the Arabs, it's like worrying about what color the Mashiach's coat's going to be. Okay?
How many Arabs were there?
A lot. 400,000? 500,000? A lot, yeah. Okay. So, there were complaints about too much interaction between Jews and Arabs, and that Jews were adopting Arab ways, like what? So, wearing a kafia, riding on horseback, gunslinging, coarse language, toxic masculinity, false bravado. All right, there were accusations that the Jews are going native. They're going native, and some were. And what's the concern? Not that any one of those bullet points is itself so disastrous, but that if the Jews become too Arabized, then their superiority, which we just spoke about a minute ago, will disappear.
Right.
And who will win in the grand scheme of things? The Arabs.
Right.
Okay, so the Jews... Well, not early on. Only later, after the State of Israel is established, they'll take the language and employment. Okay, so what about self-defense? That's the real question we have to address. Self-defense. Up until about 1907, it was customary among the Yishuvim to hire Arab or Druze or Circassian guards who did what for you? Well, either they worked appropriately or they turned against you and they stole your crops or they fired on somebody. And you couldn't really rely upon the non-Jewish defense establishment because there was no ethnic kinship. And they could turn on you at a moment's notice. So there's a real desire for Jewish self-protection. Okay. Well, is there any prior experience? The answer is yes. Because since 1903, after the Kishinev pogrom, Jewish self-defense brigades were organized in many of the shtetls and cities of the Pale. And those people were often the most likely to leave Russia because they were not willing to take Jewish suffering lying down, that they were not the old line, that it's God's will for us to suffer. No, that we're going to push back and punch back. And so those are the kinds of people who are likely to leave Europe and go somewhere else. And where? Eretz Israel. So in 1907, you have the founding of Bar Giora. Bar Giora. Yitzchak Ben Svi is a leading member in the beginning. Bar Giora. It's a clandestine organization, and they hire themselves out to the various yeshuvim to do guard duty. By 1909, they've gone from clandestine to being out in the open, and they become HaShomer. There is a direct line from Bar Giora to HaShomer to the Haganah to the IDF. Okay? It all begins in the last few years of the first decade of the 20th century. Well, HaShomer was good, but I'll raise a few criticisms. One is that sometimes they inflamed ethnic passions more than they needed to. Meaning, it's one thing to fire in response to somebody encroaching on your property and firing literally at them if your life is in danger. It's quite another to be the aggressor and ride on horseback and cause a commotion on somebody else's turf, which then leads to a shot being fired and more shots being fired and back and forth. So HaShomer was supposed to be a defensive organization, but on occasion went over the line. Okay, and their members were known for this false sense of bravado and mistreatment of women, using foul language, being very coarse. So there was what to dislike about the individual members of HaShomer.
Did they assume the kafiyah?
Yes, yes, for at least for a little while, yes.
Where does Trumpledor fit into all this?
So he's involved in HaShomer and then in the Jewish Legion. And then he dies in 1920 at Tel Chai on the Lebanese border defending the country. So he's a prominent figure in Zionist defense for about the last decade and a half of his life. Prior to that, he had been in the Russian army.
And the Turks are cool with all of this kind of...
You know, the Turks can't prevent it, and the Turks are not really interested in preventing it because they would prefer not to have brigandage and you know, pilfering. If HaShomer is going to keep people in line, then that's a good thing for law and order. And it's not as though they have heavy weapons. At best, they have a handgun. So there's no concern of like an uprising. That's not going to happen. Okay, well, HaShomer adopts the following slogan. In blood and fire, Judea fell, and in blood and fire, Judea shall rise again. I'm fighting words.
Yeah.
It's important to understand that the second Aliyah had a bit of a dichotomy. On the one hand, there was exalted rhetoric, like blood and fire, Judea will rise again. On the other hand, there was hushed tones and restrained words. And what am I talking about? The individual member of the second Aliyah wasn't worried about the Arab issue. He was worried about making a living, about having what to eat, surviving day to day in a very difficult environment, not getting contracting malaria or eye disease and dying. So the members of the second Aliyah were always judging themselves by very high standards of what they thought they could accomplish when they left Russia to go to Eretz Israel. They had very high hopes for personal fulfillment. And they're always wondering, did I succeed or did I fail? Certainly if they leave after a month's hard labor, they failed. But even those who stayed were always wondering, am I the best worker I could be? Am I doing my best 110%? They're always worried about that. And they're afraid to speak up, to glorify their experience, because maybe it's not at the level it should be. Also, they don't want to express their dreams and their hopes for the future, because their hopes for the future and their dreams are so far removed from the reality on the ground in 1907, it's embarrassing. Meaning David Ben-Gurion has his eyes on 1948, already in 1947. But you can't say that. Why? Because if you say it, people will laugh at you. It's laughable to think at Sejera, in the hot summer of 1907, that 41 years later he'd be the head of a country. So you don't talk about that. You keep it hush. So this is the dichotomy. Exalted tones, but again, hush. Okay. In 1911, Several workers were killed, Jewish workers on the Moshav, and a book was written to memorialize them. The Yisker book. The Yisker book.
How were they killed?
They were killed by Arab gunmen.
Which Moshav?
I'm not sure which one, but it wasn't all in one spot. It was in two different locations. Huh? In the Galil. Both were in the Galil. I forget which ones. I don't want to make a mistake, but they were both in the Galil. And a book was written, a Yiskor book, which included in it everybody who died either in defense of the Yishuvim or even just on the job working since the beginning of Zionism. Mm-hmm. A Yiskor book. And anybody who died, even if not in a gun battle, but just took a bullet while, you know, not even paying attention, was considered a martyr.
Yeah.
Kadosh.
Right.
But not Kadosh in the conventional sense of Kiddush Hashem. There's no Hashem here.
Kiddush Haaretz.
Good. Kibush Haaretz. And the Yizkor that we say in Shul on Yontif is Yizkor Elohim et Nishmat so-and-so, Ploni Almoni. This Yizkor is Yizkor Yisrael. Israel shall remember. What happened to God? He was left out. And what happens when you go to a Yom HaZikaron event, this Ara Yom HaZeh, to this very day, you go to, in the Manhattan, they have the big annual Yom HaZikaron event for New York City with the Consul General and the Ambassador, Yizkor Yisrael. There's no God. And then they'll let the cantor say the Kelmole, just to let the religious Jews have something, throw them a bone. But the Yizkor Yisrael was invented in 1911. What do we see? That the second Aliyah, unlike the first, does not have a very religious component to it. These are mostly very secular people, if not outright atheists, agnostics, or borderline. In the first Aliyah, you had Jews from Romania and Russia. They would go to shul in the morning, in Zichron Yaakov, they would go to Minyan, and then go out to the fields. Okay, the second Aliyah, the Kibbutzim and the Galil, there's no Minyan, you go right to the fields. So, they should have been religious. They have an extra half hour without work. Okay. Okay. So, the goal of the second Aliyah was to produce a separate economy and eventually a separate society that was Jews only. Jews only. No Arabs. In the short run, this was impossible. The Yishuv was not yet large enough.
But even that is a socialist idea.
Okay, you're right. It was a goal that was not yet attainable, because the Yishuv was still too small. But in the long run, it was attained. And how do I know that? Because by the 1930s, when the Peel Plan exists, and there are various other strategies to divide Palestine between a Jewish and Arab state, it is taken for granted that the Jewish economy could survive on its own, and that Jewish society did not need the bulk of the Arab population to be viable. Think about that for a second. It's one country, one territory, and you have a people that live there, Arabs, and Jews move in, and yes, in the beginning, they need to sell their crops to the Arabs and buy milk from the Arabs and interact with the Arabs on a regular basis, but in a relatively short order, they can create an economy that doesn't need the local population. No other colonial enterprise anywhere in the world ever accomplished that, because every other colonial enterprise still needed the local population or slave population to be viable. The Yishuv, the Zionist Yishuv, after about 4 or 5 decades, could survive on its own. And
not in the colonial enterprise.
Well, you could argue that it is, you could argue that it's not.
Not the usual standard.
No, of course not, of course not. But the fact that it was able to survive on its own was very important in 1949. Why do I say 1949? Because when the War of Independence is over, what happens when you take a railroad to the Syrian border? You hit a brick wall. Lebanese border, you hit a brick wall. Egyptian border, brick wall. You can't go anywhere. Israel now is cut off entirely from the world. Yes, you can ship from the Mediterranean, you know, off to Europe, or from Eilat, you can go to Asia. Fine, it's not totally cut off, but in its own neighborhood, Israel is an island unto itself, and it can't get out. You can't go anywhere. If the economy could not stand on its own from the Yishuv period, Israel wouldn't have been able to survive. Okay? So that was the benefit of the standalone economy. Yeah.
If you describe the Second Aliyah as people dedicated to Zionism and socialism,
yes.
Very much impacted by communism.
Not necessarily communism. Some were out and out Marxists, but most were not.
Because with Marx, his ideology is workers of the world unite.
Okay, good. So so I'm going to ask you a question for you.
Were workers, so you would think that intrinsically.
Okay, so how does socialism and the universalism that comes with socialism affect the attitude of labor Zionists towards the Arabs? The answer is, it's a very good question, the answer is that they develop neither a love nor a hate of the Arab, but rather a desire to be alone. The universalism prevented hatred. The facts on the ground prevented love. So the ideology prevented hatred, universalism, the facts on the ground of competition prevented love. In the reality, you had a desire for separation as soon as possible. It wasn't possible early on, but will become possible later. All right. Now, some of the great writers of the Second Aliyah complained that for all of our success here, there really isn't any success. Yosef Chaim Brenner was the most important of these writers. Brenner died a martyr's death in 1921 at a fairly young age. But Brenner, he complained that Palestine and Russia are the same. How are they the same? That we face an existential threat in Russia because we're a beleaguered minority there, and an existential threat in Palestine, we're a beleaguered minority there. No matter where you go, the Jews are being bossed around and can be killed at a moment's no notice. Okay, shot, nothing can do about it. Is that really true? Well, in the worst moments in Russia, it was certainly true. And in some moments in Eretz Israel, in conflict with the Arabs, it became true. So, what does he want, Yosef Chaim Brenner? He's a Zionist writer, he believes in Zionism, but he's complaining that the yeshuv is terrible because there's no physical security. Well, in the long run, you attain physical security by building up your defense industry and fighting back. But he didn't live to see that. He died, I think, in 1921. Okay. I mentioned there's a labor Zionism that is non-socialist. Who is that? Who is the great thinker of non-socialist labor Zionism? Aaron David Gordon. A.D. Gordon. Aaron David Gordon. Gordon believed in... No, that's Asher Ginsburg. So Gordon believed in the religious, almost quasi-religious value of labor. Getting your hands into the soil. Working. Huh? Avodah Atzmit, right. No. He was from Russia, but he's from Grodno. He was from Grodno, and he came to Israel in 1904 as an older man. He was no spring chicken. All these other fellows who came were in their late teens, early 20s. They were young people. They could work. They could work hard. He was, I think, 48 when he moved to Israel, and he became a day laborer. Wow. And at night he wrote his epistles. And his whole point was, there is tremendous spiritual value and personal gain in working the soil, in getting your hands dirty. And he did it. And he did it until he died. It was tremendous. He was a prophet of avodah, of work. But not everybody could be like that. And so some people had to have a more comfortable existence. So what was that possibility in the Second Aliyah? To become an urban dweller. So the first Jewish city will be built, Tel Aviv. Why was Tel Aviv built? The answer is that Jaffa was a miserable place. Jaffa had long had a Jewish community, but ethnic tensions between Jews and Arabs were making it less comfortable for Jews to live in Jaffa. And so the Achuzat Bait Corporation, which had just recently been founded, decided to establish a suburb of Jaffa on the dunes to the north. That became known as Tel Aviv. Why the name Tel Aviv? What was Tel Aviv? Tel Aviv was the name of what book? Tel Aviv. No, it was the Hebrew name of Herzl's Alt New Land. Tel Aviv. Okay, so it started in 1909, And it gets off the ground, and by the mid-19-teens, it's already with a population of about 2,000, and it grows and grows and grows out of Yom HaZeh. So urban development is important. It's not the idealized or romanticized version of living in Eretz Yisrael, but will become very, very important, because not everyone was meant to live on the soil and to engage in rough physical labor. And certainly in the later Aliyot, certainly the fourth Aliyah, which is a middle-class bourgeois Aliyah, they're not going to work the soil. So they're going to need Jewish cities to exist in order for them to have a place to live. Okay. Okay, what about Hebrew? Let's talk about Hebrew in the few minutes we have left. So, actually, before we get to Hebrew, I mentioned there was a riot in Jaffa in 1908. On Erev Purim, Tanis Esther. All throughout those years, the Zionist leadership was looking, when will be the first flowering of Arab nationalism? When will they start pushing back against us with physical violence on a large scale? And people thought this was it. The Arabs are onto us. Arab nationalism. Brawl, major brawl in Jaffa. It turned out that was just a blip on the radar. It wasn't Arab nationalism. It was just good old-fashioned ethnic hatred. Okay, Jews don't like Arabs, Arabs don't like Jews. We're fighting for a small space, competing for resources. One punch led to another punch, led to another punch. Things got out of order. But it was not Arab nationalism. That would not begin until after the First World War in Eretz Israel. But I just wanted to show you that they were sensitive, when is it going to begin? And even a few fisticuffs could lead to a great worry. But not to Hebrew. So, the problem with Hebrew early on was that it lacked many words. Okay, it's a biblical language, rabbinic language, but doesn't have all the requisite words for modern society. Who's busy working on that? Eliezer ben Yehuda and other colleagues as well. But ben Yehuda does the great bulk of the work. In what language were the children learning in the yeshuv in those years? So, some kids went to French schools, Alliance Israelite Universelle. The Alliance paid for some schools. Other kids learned in German. The Hilfsverein für Deutschen Juden was paying for some schools. And others learned in Hebrew. And some learned all three. Okay? But what happens when you want to develop more advanced education in Eretz Israel, past elementary school, high school, a gymnasia, or for that matter, eventually a university. So, already in 1903, there was talk about eventually having a Hebrew university as part of a cultural Zionist platform, that there should be a center in Israel, will put sparks out to the world. Hebrew university, the foundation stone is not laid until 1918, and classes don't begin until 1925. But, what about a high school? So Herzliya Gymnasia is established in 1906, and then the Technion, the Technikum in Haifa. And here's where we have the language battle. The Hilfsverein and fancy, wealthy German Jewish donors were the ones who paid for this school, and they wanted it to be in German, because aside from the fact that they are representatives of German Kultur, also realistically, what is the language of modern science? German. Okay? So it was a logical choice, but the Hebrew Teachers Association in Palestine threw a fit, Eliezer ben Yehuda threw a fit, and everyone was going to the ramparts saying, oh, we have to have it in Hebrew, must be in Hebrew. So this battle raged, the battle over the languages, from 1912 to February of 1914. German won the first round. In 1913 they said it's going to be in German. But then they reversed themselves. It'll be in Hebrew. The final decision was in Hebrew. This was of critical importance because it meant that those who were the intellectual elite of Eretz Yisrael were going to speak Hebrew, number one, and do advanced work in Hebrew. And it was a stepping stone towards eventually having even universities in the Hebrew language. I don't think so, because by the end of World War I, Hebrew had been so entrenched and established that there was no turning back. What made a difference was, however, the fact that the British won the war and conquered Eretz Israel, because that meant that English for the next 30 years would be the language of government in the land of Israel, and that educated Jews, or Jews who had to interact with the authorities, had to become proficient in English, which was useful in the long run, because then when Israel was established, their major backer is the United States. So the people who needed to speak English already spoke English. I mean, Ben-Gurion learned English when he went to America during the war, but even others, typically, the politically important Israelis had to know English because they knew it from the Mandate era. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Yiddish was the language of the first Aliyah. Yiddish was the language of the second Aliyah. However, with an important point, plenty of people from the second Aliyah already knew Hebrew, spoke in Hebrew before they got off the boat in Israel. They knew it from Europe, because Hebrew was already being taught as a modern language in Zionistically oriented households from the 1880s and 90s onward. So Ben-Gurion was fluent in Hebrew before he came to Palestine. Not everyone was. There were plenty of others who had to pick it up along the way. And there were plenty of others who preferred Yiddish even after they were fluent in Hebrew. But which Israeli prime minister always preferred Yiddish? Levi Eshkol. Eshkol always loved Yiddish. He would much rather have that than Hebrew. But he learned Hebrew when he got there to Israel. So the people understood different languages. What they did not learn, and this is important, they didn't learn Arabic. Jews did not pick up Arabic during the second Aliyah, during the third Aliyah, the fourth and the fifth. Okay, Jews of the first Aliyah sometimes picked up Turkish and a little bit of Arabic too, because there was nobody but, you know, the others, the Gentiles. But from the second Aliyah all the way through the establishment of the state, there really wasn't much incentive to speak Arabic or to learn Arabic, and so people didn't. Yeah.
That's like an unspoken way of saying, we don't take you seriously.
Right.
So we don't take anything about you seriously.
Right. It's not until after the establishment of the state that it becomes necessary for a certain element of the Jewish population to learn Arabic in order to deal with the Arab population, for defense and security issues, and just for basic interaction for government services. But certainly during the Yishuv period, they didn't bother. Yeah.
Are the three languages enshrined in law today?
So the street signs are supposed to be in all three, English, Hebrew, and Arabic. But the nationality law that they just passed last year downgraded Arabic to lower than Hebrew, which was one of the big criticisms of Netanyahu, that it was a bigoted law or something like that. Okay, last point for today. That is, okay. When Zionism is established, it's an international movement. Jews who live in Germany are Zionists. Jews who live in Russia are Zionists. France, England, okay, all over the place, you have Zionists. When the world goes to war, what happens to an international movement? Can you collaborate with someone who is an enemy alien, but yet you're both Jewish and both ideologically on the same wavelength?
Intersectionality.
So, okay, good. What will your host government say about you if you're caught interacting in a friendly manner with citizens of an enemy country, even though it happens to be you're interacting on Jewish issues and Jewish affairs have nothing to do with the World War, but still, it doesn't look kosher? Okay, then let's make things a little even more complicated. What happens if you live in Eretz Israel? It's controlled by the Ottomans. The Ottomans are part of the war. Okay, they're on the side with the Germans against the British and the French and the Russians. And you have population who lives there who are Jews. But they have citizenship. Some of them are Ottomans, but most are not. Most of them are Russian citizens or Habsburg citizens or whatever, but some European state. And if that state happens to be at war with you, what are you going to do with them? You're going to expel them, imprison them, draft them? What are you going to do? There are many, many questions that the Zionist movement and the Yishuv face at the start of the war. A war that, in theory, has nothing to do with the enterprise of Zionism or the desire to build up Eretz Yisrael. In theory, has nothing to do with it. But in the end, will have everything to do with it. Because the very fact of the war will allow political Zionism to progress where it had stalled for a decade and a half. So think about these things. What is the fate of the individual Jew in trying to pursue the Zionist agenda during wartime? See you next week.